Right, so there are new notes for today, new homework assignment, and all this stuff that you've given me so far is graded and available here, including the exam, etc. So everybody that took the exam got a perfect score. So apparently you're understanding something. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have seen the proof, that Nova special? Just curious. It's on Fermat's Last Theorem. It's pretty good. Okay, just curious. Since I just have the tape, there just happens to be a VHS player here. So.
How long is it?
It's really good, actually. It's, how long is it? 60 minutes.
Show is a Halloween treat.
I'll think about it. So, so the new section of the notes you should have, and I'll talk about Eisenstein series and really a structure theorem for the nature of modular forms of level one. Yes?
Recorder?
It is. Good job. Remind me. Amazingly enough, I turned it on. Thank you. So our goal is to understand why the following is true. Or what is, here's the ultimate goal. So last week I defined for any congruent subgroup gamma and any integer weight k greater than or equal to, well, any integer weight k, I defined a space mk gamma. And this is a space of modular forms of weight k for the congruent subgroup gamma. It's a fact that it's a finite dimensional complex vector space. I didn't prove that these are finite dimensional, but they are finite dimensional. And I will say something about that, at least in the case, in various situations. But you have a whole bunch of finite dimensional complex vector spaces. The goal for the rest of this course is to give you some indication of how these can be computed explicitly. One helpful fact is that elements of MK gamma can be represented as formal power series in q to the 1 over h, where h is a positive integer. So here, the matrix 1H01, you require that's in gamma, but if that's in gamma, then you can represent each element here. It has a Fourier expansion in terms of q to the 1 over h, recalling that q to the 1 over h, that's just a function of z, which is e to the 2 pi I z divided by h. That's just a rescaled version of the usual exponential function. So the question is about how to compute these. What are some ways that allow you to compute a basis for this, where you can give a basis of this by giving the first few terms of power series expansions of each other basis? So today we're going to focus on MKSL2Z. So gamma is now equal to SL2Z for today, and also on Wednesday. And here, there's a fairly elementary algorithm to write down a basis for MK. So the rest of the week, I'll let MK equal MKSL2Z. Inside of here, we have a subspace called SK, and it's called the space of cusp forms. It'll play a key role as well. These are the forms that have the property that they vanish at each of the cusps. With SL2Z, you just have the one cusp at infinity. And vanishing at infinity means that when you look at the formal power series, or Q series expansion of the form at infinity, it has constant term equal to zero. So these are forms such that F equals sum n equals 1 to infinity, a sub n, q to the n. This is just for SL2Z. In general, you have to require this for the q expansion of F about each of the cusps. But for SL2Z, there's only one cusp up to equivalence. So this is the same as saying that if you were to substitute q equal to 0 in here, and that's the limit as z goes to I infinity of q of z, equal to the limit e to the 2 pi iz. If you plug in larger and larger values of z, larger in the sense that they're multiples of I and they're far away from the origin, this will go to zero very quickly. So the right notion of vanishing at infinity is that when you substitute q equal to zero here, you get zero, which is the same as the constant term being zero. That's why it's a sum from n equals 1 to infinity instead of 0 to infinity. So that's the definition of a cusp form. I haven't yet given you any examples of any of these yet, but I will in a minute. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write down a form E4, and it will be an element of M4. I'll write down another form E6, which will be an element of M6. And then, you'll recall that if you have two modular forms, you can multiply them together and get a modular form. If you have two modular forms of the same weight, you can add them together and get another modular form. If you take E4 and E6 and do what I just described, multiplying and adding them together over and over again in an appropriate manner, you'll get every single element of MK SL2Z for all K. So everything is easily explained in terms of these two elements. Now, let me tell you more details. So here they are. Well, first I'll define for each k greater than or equal to 4 even, and I wrote this down at the very end of class last time, I'll define functions g sub k. The e sub k are simply scalar multiples of the g sub k, normalized so that the coefficients in the q expansion are rational numbers. G sub k, when you compute its q expansion, some of the coefficients will be transcendental, so that's not so good. So here's the definition of G sub k. Its value at an element z in the upper half plane is the sum of all pairs of integers m and m of 1 over mz plus n to the k. And here, the star above the sum simply means that you omit pairs of m and n so that mz plus n is equal to 0. So that means that you omit the one pair mn equal to minus n over n. So for example, if z is not a rational number, then you wouldn't omit anything. You only omit something if z is a rational number. So what you omit depends on the value of z that you plug in. So the first proposition, gk is the modular form of gk. There'll be several propositions that I'm going to prove that have sort of two components. One is a natural, one is an application of some basic result from complex analysis, and the other is an application of the definitions that I've given so far. And what I'm going to do is state the part of the proof that is an application of something from complex analysis or a series manipulation, and I'll just give a reference to that part of the proof. Which is given in this book. In each case, the part of the proof that is complex analysis is in here, and then I'll give you the other part of the proof, so that you won't need to know any theorems from complex analysis in order to follow what I'm doing. So, the assertion that GK is MK, well, I really tried to hammer in the definition last week of what a modular form is. It's a holomorphic function on the upper half plane, it's holomorphic at the cusps, and transforms in a certain way under SL2Z. So there are two statements here. One is that GK is holomorphic everywhere, and including at infinity, and the other is that it transforms in the right way under SL2Z. The holomorphicity uses some basic complex analysis and some understanding of GK. So it uses something about a sum being uniformly bounded in a certain place, et cetera, et cetera. It's described in complete detail in Serre's book, and the reference is given in the notes. So I'll skip that. But just note that if you were to take any finite subsum of this, so just sum over a finite number of things, then you're just getting a rational function, and that's holomorphic, away from the places where it has poles. And you've omitted those factors, at least that point Z. So without saying more, this is holomorphic. The second part is that GK is invariant in the appropriate sense under the action of SL2Z. Remember, SL2Z has these two generators, S and T. One of them is translation, Z goes to Z plus 1. That's the linear fractional transformation induced by T. And the other is Z goes to minus 1 over Z. So all you have to do is verify that for gamma equal to each of these, so put it this way, GK bar TK has to equal GK, and GK or SK equals GK. So if we check each of these equalities, then we'll have verified that GK satisfies the right transformation under SL2Z, because S and T then generate all of SL2Z. So we'll just check each of these directly, and then given the holomorphicity which we're assuming, we'll know that GK is a modular form of weight K. Okay, any questions? All right, so now this will work as follows. So for the first one, GK bar TK this is by definition, so you have the CZ plus D to the minus K, but T is just given by the matrix 1, 1, 0, 1. So CZ plus D is just 1, so there's no extra factor up front that you have to worry about. And here you have GK of Z plus 1. So that's what this is evaluated at Z. It's GK of Z plus 1. But notice, if you replace z by z plus 1 in this big sum, well, you're just adding, well, let's see what you get. This is sum m and integers 1 over m z plus 1 plus n dk. And that's the sum 1 over mz plus m plus n. And so you're really summing over exactly the same thing. You get exactly the same sum. So this is equal to GK of Z. Because you just replace the other integer by that, you're summing over everything, so it doesn't make any difference at all. So that proves the first part. Now the second one, let's consider GK bar S, K at Z. And here, yes, please.
This isn't always. I mean, this. Okay, this converges uniformly.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about.
Right. Yeah. In fact, the way you prove the holomorphicity is by proving it converges uniformly. So you don't have to worry at all. This is allowed from how you prove holomorphicity. So, just in order to not assume complex analysis, I'm just brushing up under the rug some of those details. Okay, here, so GK bar SK of Z, the CZ plus D factor is Z to the K, and then you have G minus 1 over Z. Of k minus 1 over z. And now what's this equal to? Well, it is the definition of gk, and z to the k times the sum 1 over m minus 1 over z plus n to the power of k. And now, just multiply the top and bottom by z to the k, and we'll see what happens. I think I might have got the sign backwards or something. It seems funny. Oh, yeah. It's Cz plus d to the minus k in the definition of the bar k gamma bar k action. So there should be a minus k right here. Okay. And now multiply the top and the bottom by z to the k in order to clear the denominator here. And you end up with a z to the k on the top, which cancels out the z to the minus k right here in front of the infinite sum. So you are left with sum over m and n in z 1 over minus mz plus, let's see, wait, I got rid of the z. 1 over minus m plus n z all to the power of k. And we've just, all you've done is switch the sign of m and the ordering of the m and the n. And again, since you're summing over all possibilities for m and n, that makes no difference at all. So again, you get g sub k of z. So this proves that g sub k is a modular form of weight k. Any questions? Also, if you keep in mind how this part of the proof worked, you can always remember whether or not there should be a plus or a minus sign in the action of SL2z here in this formula. Because here you notice that the z to the k comes out on top, and you have to cancel that out with the z to the minus k here. So it's a good way of remembering the definition of the action, seeing that this works. Okay, so that's the first proposition, gk is in mk. Another fact is that gk of infinity, by which I mean the limit as z goes to I infinity of gk of z, well, this is closely related to the Riemann zeta function. Look what happens. If you let z go to I infinity here, this part goes to, well, this part goes to infinity, but let's see, divide the top and the bottom by z to the k. Again, using uniform convergence, but divide the top and the bottom by z to the k. So, let's see, 1 over z to the k plus n over z to the k. Now you're letting z go to I infinity. So, let's see, I think I made a mistake. Doing something stupid. Right. Okay, so you don't have to bother even doing what I just did. You just leave it like this, z plus n to the k. And just notice that if m is non-zero here, then this sum, this summand of the infinite sum for m not equal to zero, it just goes to zero, because you're taking a limit as z goes to I infinity. So the denominator becomes very large for that fixed choice of m and n, and so it goes to zero. So the only summands that survive are the ones with m equal to zero. And you have those for both n and its negative, because you're summing over the integers, k k is even, so the negative, well, you just get this each n twice. So you end up getting that this is twice sum 1 over n to the k for n greater than or equal to 1. But sum 1 over n to the k, that's this, the value of the Riemann zeta function at k. So this is 2 zeta of k. This means that when we consider the q expansion of g sub k, well, the constant term is the volume at infinity. So it's going to look like 2 zeta k plus some higher order terms. So I think I'll skip around for a second. In proposition 1.44, there's the Q expansion of GK. So I'll just write it down. GK, let's see, it's 2 zeta k plus, remembering that q is e to the 2 pi I z, it's 2 zeta k plus, and there's this slightly annoying transcendental factor, 2 pi I to the k over k minus 1 factorial times this very nice sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, of sigma sub k minus 1 of n q to the n. Here, sigma k minus 1 of n is the sum of the k minus first powers of the divisors of n. It's the sum over the integers between 1 and n inclusive, and a divided n of that integer to the power of k minus 1. So the fact that GK has this power series expansion is again a standard thing you learn in, say, Serre's book. And the proof, well, he just takes pi cotangent pi z. So basically he starts with a power series expansion of cotangent, does a whole bunch of manipulations, and arrives at this fact. And I'm going to skip that again, since it's beautifully written up in here and you can easily read it. And I want to focus more on how to compute with these things rather than proving the standard facts, which you may have seen before. So, and the proof, see Serre's book. And it really is just manipulate the power series for tangent of z, really. Now, the next thing we need to do is try to get rid of this annoying transcendental factor. And you can do that by using the following. So, skip ahead again. So again, using cotangent, actually, in this case, z cotangent of z, you can figure out what zeta of k is explicitly. It's minus 2 pi I to k over 2k factorial. And notice the nice thing that there's this thing factoring out. And there's another number here, ek. This number is called a Bernoulli number. And I'll tell you what the definition is in a minute. But the key fact about it is that it's a rational number. So if you factor out 2 pi I to the k from zeta of k, you end up getting something that's a rational number. So the transcendence disappears here. What you really have is a transcendental factor times an element of q, double brackets, little q. So this is of that form. this is a, if you write this, it's a transcendental number times what I'll call EK of Z, where EK has a power series expansion in, or with coefficients that are rational numbers.
Okay? So that relies on, of course, this evaluation of the zeta function. And again, this is something that is written down in detail in SERS notes, and it involves looking at the series for z cotangent of z. So let's see. I still haven't defined ek. I've just noted that this is power of pi, and then there's an ek. You factor out that power of pi and I when you get this series. Okay. So first, I think I will step back a little and tell you. I want to mention another example. So I've now given you a whole bunch of examples of modular forms. G sub k. You have G sub 4, G sub 6, G sub 8, and so on. And these are visibly non-zero functions. For example, they're non-zero in infinity. So you now have a whole bunch of examples. I haven't given you any examples of cusp forms, though. These functions are non-zero at infinity. So here's how you can make a cusp form. So I'll return to Bernoulli numbers shortly, but what about cusp forms? So we have G4, that's not a cusp form, but it's in M4. We have G6, also not a cusp form, it's in M6. What you can do is you can take, there's another thing, which is G4 cubed. What space is that in? What's its weight?
Just 4.
No. So G4 itself has weight 4, since it's in M4. So what about this cube? What happens to the transformation condition when you multiply two modular forms together? For example, G4 times itself.
So 12.
Yes, exactly. It has weight 12. Very good. Okay. What about G6 squared? The notation sort of helps you, yeah.
Six?
No. Excellent. So that's 12 also. So we have two different things. Maybe different. We don't know. Maybe they're the same. But we have two things that are elements of M12. And we know what their constant terms are. So it turns out if you consider delta, which is equal to 60 times G4 on the whole thing cubed, minus 27 times 140 G6 squared, here I've taken exactly the right linear combination of G4 cubed and G6 squared so that the constant term of the Q expansions of these two things cancel out, and I get 0. This difference, it has a power series, and that power series starts out with actually 1 times Q. I think it's Q plus higher order terms. So this delta, which I've just defined, is certainly an element of M12, because it's simply the difference of two elements of M12. And it's a cusp form. We don't know that it's non-zero yet, but it is a cusp form. So it's in S12. But we do have this Q expansion for G4 and G6. So we find that, so right, there was a constant, but that constant's 1 if you look at the actual power series. So you know it's a non-zero customer in S12. So that's an example of a cusform, delta. And its coefficients if you just label them tau, then they are called the values of the Ramanujan tau function. There are a lot of many, many interesting properties that this function has. There are congruences. So, you know, n, if you have two values of n that you want to substitute in, and they're congruent modulo something, then you can say something about how, what their output is congruent modulo. There's also a bound on the size. For example, if p is prime in the absolute value of tau of p is less than or equal to 2 p to the 11 over 2. So they could be pretty big, but they're not insanely big. Notice that they are much smaller than the coefficients of, G12. So G12, the coefficients of G12 are the sum of the 11th powers of the divisors. So, for example, if n is prime, that would be 1 plus that prime to the power of 11. And that's a lot bigger than 11 over 2. So the coefficients of delta are pretty small compared to the coefficients of these Eisenstein series, weighted 12. Here's a conjecture, which I'll say is due to Bass-Edixhoven. It's essentially proven, but he hasn't written down the proof. She does a lot. So Edixhoven claims that one can compute tau of p, which is an integer, by the way, in time polynomial in the number of digits of p, so in log p. So that's one of the sort of questions you might ask about delta. And it's not quite proved yet, but they claim they can essentially prove it. They just seem to have issues of writing down the proof. But it is it's a good motivating question. So, let's see. By the way, this delta, the reason I call it delta is that it's a discriminant of a certain elliptic curve. More precisely, if you let's see. Remark. Delta is the discriminant of an elliptic curve. So if you write if you let lambda be a lattice in the upper half plane determined by two elements omega 1 and omega 2, and you consider tau equal to omega 1 over omega 2 and assume that that's in the upper half plane, then there's an elliptic curve with the equation y squared equals 4x cubed minus 60 g4 of tau times x minus 140 g6 of tau. And this delta is the discriminant of that elliptic curve. Delta of tau equals the discriminant the square stress equation for an electric car. So somehow this delta, this function delta, if you, whenever you have a point in the upper half named a tau, you get an elliptic curve from it with this equation. And delta is the function that, given a tau, gives you the discriminant of that elliptic curve. So it's kind of amazing. So delta is somehow this function that gives you the discriminants of the points, the elliptic curves corresponding to points in the upper half plane. Notice one consequence of this fact is that delta is non-zero evaluated at any point in the upper half plane, because discriminants of elliptic curves are always non-zero. So just another fact is that delta tau not equal to zero for all tau in the upper half plane. At infinity, delta is zero, because we'll just look at its two expansion. I constructed it exactly so that at infinity it would be zero. But all the other points it isn't. So you shouldn't, if you don't already know something about this, you shouldn't see exactly why this is true. I'm just telling you this as a remark. And I won't use it again. It's just to indicate why this thing's called delta. All right, so what remains is to tell you about Bernoulli numbers, which allow you to understand E sub k. Once I do that, then I can explain how to obtain a basis for everything at level one. But maybe we should stop and watch this movie. What do you think? So this would be a good time to stop and do that. So any questions I want to stick this in over. Haven't rewound the tape in a long time. I think I give it again in the notes here. But I'm trying to remember if I give it the notes I've handed out already.
Maybe. What was that?
I haven't given it away. So I'll just write it on the... Oh, it's in the homework, actually. Yeah. Oh, the notation is given in problem one of the homework.
Okay.
Recalled there. So this is a pretty amazing movie made by Simon Singh, which was played on TV on, I guess, PBS about 10 years ago. And the Simon Singh guy's written a couple of books about Fermat's theorem and cryptography and related things. I met him once in Berkeley. He's a nice guy, except I don't see anything yet. Dude, I feel like it's like something similar.